going to talk tonight about basic physics, by which I mean the theory of how the material world is put together at the atomic and the nuclear levels. My interest is not in basic physics itself, but in what people say about it and the philosophical conclusions they draw about what the world is like and, by implication, what God is like. You might reasonably ask, why is this important? Why does it matter how some philosophers use physics to support their views? It matters because some of their views are hostile to what Christians hold to be important, such as there is objective truth, and that it is possible to talk about it in a reasonable way. And because physics is the pinnacle of objective and rational discovery, if physics really does support the views of these radical philosophers, then objectivity and rationality are themselves just illusions, and the world is truly absurd. This contradicts the claim of the Bible that God's creation is good and that it reflects His glory. I will begin by saying some general things about the difference between the world of basic physics and the world of our normal experience, and then go on to consider three questions. The reality question: is there a real world out there, or is it an illusion of our minds? The uncertainty question: can we be sure of anything about nature, or is everything random and uncertain? And the truth question: does real truth exist, or is all truth socially determined? That's kind of a buzz phrase that is used by social scientists today. Are these reasonable questions? Well, you have to judge for yourself. But perhaps you may find it at least interesting to see how some people use the discoveries of basic physics to argue their views, and perhaps to consider whether their claims can hold up under scrutiny. I would like to talk about two worlds of physics. Basic physics deals with electrons and photons. Both of these elementary particles were discovered in the early 1900s. There are other elementary particles, but they don't affect our lives so directly or actively as electrons and photons. It has been said that everything we experience in chemistry, physics, and biology ultimately boils down to things that happen between photons and electrons. So what happens in basic physics is very important in our lives, and yet the material world that we see in our daily lives is very different from the world of electrons and photons. One big difference is this. When we experience the normal world around us, we are dealing with vast numbers of particles that are individually doing their own thing, following the laws of physics. Our experience is a collective result of all of these particles working together to form a steady average, even if individual behavior appears to be chaotic. They follow statistical properties that are called the laws of large numbers. A general rule of such laws is that the larger the numbers, the more closely the results conform to average behavior. People who do various kinds of statistical analysis, conduct political polls, or sell life insurance, rely on laws of large numbers to give meaning to their data. But there is one big difference between any statistical analysis that humans perform and the statistical behavior of the physical world, and that has to do with the numbers involved. Virtually anything that we meet in our daily encounter with the material world involves such vast numbers of elementary particles that the word average loses its meaning. And the laws of large numbers just become laws with deviations from average performance that are too small to measure. I'm going to do a little experiment now to help you to visualize what I mean by large. If you had any chemistry or physics, you know about Avogadro's number. It's the number of atoms in a gram mole of any element. And the number is 6.02 times 10 to the 23rd. Now, I'm going to be very unkind to all of you who don't understand scientific notation. I'm going to just stick with it, and because I don't have time to explain everything, okay? So you'll have to go ask the teacher what that means. So 6.02 times 10 to the 23rd atoms in a gram mole of any element. And I happen to have an element sitting here, and I brought back my truck up to get a gram mole of it. And this element has, this is 12 grams of carbon. The atomic weight of carbon is 12, at least the normal carbon. And this is good enough for our purposes. And so here's 12 grams of carbon. 12 grams is about 4 pennies, the weight of 4 pennies. I think each penny weighs approximately 3 grams, okay? So you could do this in your kitchen. Now, I wouldn't suggest you do this in your kitchen because it's pretty messy. But it turns out, in fact, this is what I've practiced this thing, it turns out that flour has just about the same volume as carbon. So I measured out 12 grams of flour, and if you mess up with the flour, it's much less problem with your wife or mother or whoever it is you're responsible to. So what we're going to do is I'm still in the process of going to try to I can't take a lot of time on this because I got a lot to cover here. But what we're going to do is try to illustrate what 6.02 times 10 to the 23rd means. And the way you do this is by dividing this in half. So I'll take half of it, and I try not to drop it on the floor. Okay. Now I need to have somebody count. Brendan, why don't you count? Well, that's number one, right?
One.
Take half of it again.
Two.
Okay. Take half of it again, half of it again. This is not, the whole class is going to, this is not going to be the whole hour. Half of it again.
Four.
Operations analysis is very boring work. It's very half of it again.
Five.
Okay. Okay, half of it again. Like chalk against the blackboard. Again.
Seven.
Again.
Eight.
I'm going to stop at 10 here. Again.
Nine.
Again.
Ten.
Okay, let's clean that up a little bit. That's 10. Now, what I did was each time I divided the pile in half, and when you divide it 10 times, what you have done, in effect, is divide, you now are at 1,000th of the original pile. Because 2 to the 10 is equal to 1,024, which is close enough to 1,000 for my kind of work. And there's, that's 1,000, okay? A little blot or stuff in the middle. That's, if I did it precisely right, that would be 12 milligrams. I started off with 12 grams, and that's 12 milligrams, okay? Now, I have to switch to a person who is more precise than I am, and Brendan's going to divide that 10 times more. Okay, Brendan? There's one, two, three, four, five, six, don't cheat, seven, eight, nine, ten. Okay, clear that blob over here. Okay. So that's, you can see that. That's actually, I think you were very generous. Clearly you couldn't go very much further, okay? Now, so that's 20 times. Now, if we divided it first 10 times, okay, and we divided it 10 times again, so that is 6.02 times 10 to the 17th atoms are in that little speck there, okay? Okay? Actually, this morning when we did it, it was about a tenth of that size, but that's all right. But here's, suppose the population of the world is approximately 6 billion, okay? How many worlds worth of people would that many atoms correspond to? A billion is 369, right? That would be 10 to the 8, which is 100 million. So, The number of atoms in that little speck is the same, is about the same as you would have on 100 million Earths in people. Okay? That's a lot of atoms. You think a sample of 1,000 for a political poll is pretty good. A sample of 1,000 in a political poll gives you an answer plus or minus 3%. If you could sample 600,000 trillion, if you could sample 600,000 trillion, you'd have an accuracy to about 8 decimal points, okay? Whatever that would mean. So what I'm trying to get across, now this is the only experiment we're going to do tonight. I, you know, usually if you don't have an experiment that blows something up, people are very unhappy with you. But I'm the more temperate type, so I don't quite do that. The point in bringing this up is that when you learn something that is true in basic physics, and then you ask what it means in our world, your answer should consider the vast difference between what happens to an individual photon or electron and what happens in our world. Many differences come from two related facts. The effect of averaging performance over such a vast number of particles. No matter what you're looking at, it's got trillions and trillions and trillions of atoms. Secondly, the fact that energy doesn't average, it adds up. So that even the smallest speck of our visible world involves vast amounts of energy compared with what happens between an electron and a photon. Okay? So what is the effect of these differences between our world and the world of basic physics? Well, we'll see. Now, just so you don't get too confused, when I talk about basic physics, I'll sometimes talk about the quantum world or the atomic world, and these are kind of interchangeable. There is another world, just for those of you who really know about physics, the nuclear world, which lays below the atomic world, and we're not going to say much about it, because its special forces and particles do not normally impact the chemistry and biology of our world. If we were talking about creation, then the nuclear world would be of central importance, because it would talk about the creation of matter, for example. But we'll defer that discussion to another time. The world of our normal experience is called the classical world, or the visible world, and we'll use these words interchangeably. The physics of the visible world is called classical physics, and also sometimes referred to classical physics. It's the physics practiced by Newton and his successors. And the distinction between these two worlds is primarily a matter of the numbers of particles involved and the energy. The energy in that little speck is vast compared with what happens between an electron and a photon. Well, let's talk a little bit more about what the basic physics is like. Let's talk about some features of basic physics. Here, this is the classical story. I have to bring you up. I have to bring up some points, and then I'll start talking about the talk. Some features of basic physics. First, simplicity. The first thing that must strike you about the world of basic physics is its simplicity. The entire material world is built up of only a handful of types of particles. Electrons, protons, neutrons. All the electrons are recognizably alike, as are all protons and neutrons. These particles combine in only 90 or so different elements characterized by the number of electrons or protons. This simple structure is the same everywhere in the universe, except where extreme density or heat cause nuclear changes. But that's nuclear physics, which we will not go into. For the same reason, we will not say much about protons and neutrons, because they have to do with the nucleus. This handful of particle types follow a few basic rules. These rules are called conservation laws. The most important law is the conservation of energy. Energy cannot be created or destroyed. Another law is the conservation of angular momentum. If a system is spinning, there's no way to change the spin without borrowing energy from somewhere outside the system. Another law is the conservation of charge. It's not possible to change the net electrical charge of a system unless something's added from outside. There are some 10 conservation laws in all, most of which I don't even know off the tip of my tongue, at least. And they're not really important for most of what we do. Those are the most important. I did not mention the conservation of mass as a law, because Einstein showed that mass is just another form of energy. He stated this in his famous equation, E equals MC squared. So when two deuterium atoms fuse to form helium, there appears to be new energy created. But this is not so, because the mass of helium is less than the sum of the masses of the two deuterium atoms by exactly the amount that equates to the energy released. That's according to E equals MC squared. If you look down the table of the elements in the chemical handbook or CRC table, as it gets to call it, you'll see element hydrogen, helium, and so forth, maybe the isotopes, and you'll see very precise calculations of their masses, and you just sort of, you add up, this could be made out of two hydrogens and one helium, or something like that, or three heliums, or two heliums and a hydrogen. And then you add the masses up, and you'll discover that the end result, I'm telling a lie now, the end result up to iron, approximately, is that the combination has less mass than you would expect by putting the parts together. The difference is the energy that is released when those come together. I didn't intend to talk about this, but after iron, you have the other thing happening. That's why uranium splits with fission, whereas hydrogen fuses with. Anyway, okay, my heavens, why should I talk about sidetracks? Okay, granularity. Very few rules, very few object types. Energy does not move smoothly from one object to another. It moves in chunks called photons or quanta. This is true in the visible world, of course, but the chunks are too small to notice. In the quantum world, sizes are scaled down to the point where chunks become quite noticeable. I will talk about making observations or measurements. That's the only way we can find out what's going on around us. Every observation or measurement requires an exchange of energy between us, or whatever device we use, and the thing we are looking at, say an electron. This observation energy is found in our macro world as well as in the atomic world. It's interesting to realize that the ancient philosophers were keenly aware of the energy of observation. The old Greek language used in Homer's epics used over a dozen different verb roots and several times that many word variations to express the act of seeing. The words that we use now, skeptic, prophet, lamp, lucid, and phenomenon, come directly from these ancient verb roots. Vision was closely tied to understanding and perception in the ancient Greek thought, and so it is when we probe the atomic world, as we will find out in a minute. The energy exchange and observation always involves photons. Physicists call photons light, but when they say light, they don't just mean visible light. Visible light is just a small part of a huge spectrum of electromagnetic energy that goes from low frequency AM radio waves through FM and radar bands to infrared to the visible rainbow of light, red, yellow, green, blue, violet, and on to ultraviolet, X-rays, and very high frequencies beyond. The highest frequencies observed in the natural world are certain cosmic rays, which apparently come from very energetic galactic processes and have energies just below the energy required to create an electron. Incidentally, if you do have enough energy to create an electron, you still can't do it because of the charge conservation law. But if you have twice the energy needed to create an electron, then you can produce an electron-positron pair. Now that's just for the benefit of those of you who worry about such things. Electric and magnetic forces are just special cases of electromagnetic energy and also involve the exchange of photons. The study of this exchange is called quantum electric dynamics, QED. And one of my favorite physicists, Richard Feynman, wrote a very accessible, very readable book called QED, The Strange Theory of Light and Matter. And it really is quite a good book. So if you're interested in this, I would suggest strongly to you see if you can find it. When I say all energy exchanges, I mean all that directly affect our world. There are other type of energy exchanges at the nuclear level, but they don't affect normal chemistry and biology. And then there's gravity. Nobody seems to know for sure how gravity exchanges its energy. The so-called gravitons are just speculation, as far as I know. But in any case, at the atomic level, gravity is an extremely small force compared with electrical force. Next, I want to talk about non-locality. Photons and electrons are a bit strange, and this is at the center of some of the philosophical problems. They're a bit strange in that they sometimes seem to be localized point particles, and other times they seem to behave like waves spread out over a region. This spread out nature is called non-locality. When they act like waves, photons and electrons behave much like mechanical waves, such as ocean waves and sound. A prominent feature of waves is that they can be focused to show interference or reinforcement. A common laboratory example of interference is what's called the two-slit experiment, and it can be used for either sound or water waves or light. Basically, the idea is you have a source of waves, and then you put a barrier consisting of two narrow poles, and then you observe what happens on the other side of the barrier. And what you observe is interference patterns. If this is the peak of an ocean wave, let's say, here's the peak. Here's the peak. So where the peaks combine from the two slots, you'll have an amplification. And where a peak from one slot hits a trough from the other slot, let's see, there. You'll have the amplification, the up on the one, the wave will cancel out the down on the other wave, and you'll end up with basically nothing. Okay? And you can actually see this. In fact, I have seen satellite pictures of atolls. You know what an atoll is? A coral barrier around an island with a couple of slits in it, a couple of holes in it where the ocean waves can come in. And you can actually see the standing waves caused by the two slits. Any wave phenomenon will have this kind of interference. Well, now, here's the dilemma. Whenever we specifically look to see whether light is smooth or granular, whether it's a photon or whether it's just a wave, it always turns out to be granular, consisting of photons. We can most easily see this. Suppose this is light, and we just decrease the intensity. As the intensity drops, it eventually reaches the point where it's literally possible to count the photons one by one as they go through this laboratory experiment. But if light really consists of photons, then the same photon can't go through both slits, so it can't interfere. How could it possibly do that? And yet it does. So this is where we come up with the mystery called wave-particle duality. It's a particle when we look at it, but when we're not looking, it interferes like a wave. So what's going on? The same thing happens with the orbits of bound electrons. You all know the Bohr model of an atom. You know, you've seen the NASA symbol with, you know, atoms going around the nucleus and so forth. I mean, electrons going around the nucleus. Well, that's not really the truth. If you look at a hydrogen atom, and you go at the lowest energy level for an atom, it's not in orbit at all. It's kind of a smear. It's kind of a fuzzball. That's because of the non-locality of the electron. But if you look for the electron in the atom, it's right here. Okay. Anytime you look for an electron in this fuzzball, it's at a specific point. But if you're not looking for it, it's a fuzzball. We'll talk about that in a minute. Okay, finally, very quickly, unpredictability. There are some things in the quantum world that are just unpredictable. For example, again, going back to the two-slit experiment, if you set it up so you can count the photons as they come to the slit, you still can't predict exactly where they're going to end up on the screen or phosphorescent plate or whatever you use. This unpredictability is not usually found in the macro world, that in the classical world. That's why classical physics is described in the way that seems to say that everything is predictable, at least in principle. It was assumed in classical physics that unpredictability came about because we just didn't have a complete picture, not due to any essential randomness in what we're looking at. Actually, there is some essential randomness even in classical physics, such as in systems that have unstable or chaotic behavior. Examples are the so-called n-body problems and weather patterns, but that sort of behavior could not be studied by the old classical physicists until fast computers were developed. It's not that they weren't aware of it, it's just that they couldn't do anything about it. They couldn't study it. First, we're going to talk about the reality question. And I want to give you the reason why the reality question becomes an issue. Let's begin with by saying what some people said about the physics, said about reality. First, consider some remarks by two of the physicists who were pioneers, Werner Heisenberg and Niels Bohr. Heisenberg said, "The idea of an objective real world whose smallest parts exist objectively in the same sense as stones or trees exist, independently of whether or not we observe them, is impossible." Heisenberg is worried about a little inconsistency in what I said earlier. I talked about the simplicity of the quantum world in that it is made up of only a few types of particles, one of which is electrons. Well, this is not quite right. Because of the wave-particle duality, electrons don't normally exist as particles as such. They're a bit more nebulous than that. Heisenberg would say they don't exist objectively until we observe them. I would agree they don't exist as particles until we observe them, but they seem quite real to me, even in the wave state, because after all, they do have consistent properties that we can measure, such as charge. Hydrogen atom, even with a fuzzball, is still neutral. It doesn't have a charge to it, which means there's got to be an electron there. Niels Bohr, and Heisenberg and Bohr were right at the beginning of quantum mechanics, so they are very prominent leaders in quantum mechanics. There is no quantum world. There is only an abstract quantum mechanical description. It's wrong to think that the task of physics is to find out how nature is. Physics concerns what we can say about nature. Bohr's remark about the abstract quantum mechanical description refers to the solutions that come out of the mathematics of atomic physics. He argues that these solutions aren't real, and that they relate to something real only when we make an observation. It doesn't take much imagination to see where some people may go with such claims. If the world is not real at the very roots, then how can it be real at all? If reality depends on our observations, then what is reality? If there is no quantum world, then does the visible world exist? Heisenberg and Bohr had the view that physicists can only talk about what they can observe, and observing things in the quantum world has problems. Their remarks are part of what is called the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics. In this view, reality becomes tangled up with our observations so that it seems as if our observations in some sense define reality. Einstein had some famous arguments with Bohr over this issue, in which Einstein took the realism viewpoint against Bohr, who you might call taking a positivist viewpoint. One such argument is called Einstein's moon. Einstein asks, does the moon exist if we don't look at it? I will return to this shortly. Others have gone even further than Heisenberg and Bohr. Here's a statement by some intellectual. Reality is a state constructed by the mind, not perceived by it. There is no real reality. There are no objective truths, only prevailing versions disseminated by the ruling social groups. We'll talk about social groups in a few minutes, too. This remark is typical of a school that debunks rational thought, a view that is common in some university humanity departments. And those of you who are involved with university humanities departments and secular universities have a pretty good idea of what I'm talking about. As a scientist, I find such statements kind of puzzling and wonder how far the author would go if pressed on the matter of no objective truth. Does he mean that pi, the ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter, is just a prevailing version and not objective truth, or that the Pythagorean theorem is not true? Or, as one person put it, the fact that sulfuric acid is not a substitute for drinking water? One of my favorite whipping boys is Gary Zukav, who wrote the book The Dancing Wu Li Masters in the mid-80s, early in the mid-80s. At the time, it was a very popular book. In the East, however, he says, there never has been much philosophical or religious confusion about matter and energy. The world of matter is a relative world and an illusory one. This remark may be calculated to irritate those of us who have a high regard for Western scholarship, and it comes from a book that's full of such irritating declarations. But Gary Zukav is perhaps more dangerous than Wilson because he's a physicist, and so would seem to have some authority behind his remarks. Where does his remarks come from? And can we say anything sensible about it? I would like to introduce some remarks with a little parable. You want to visit a car lot to look for a new car. So you take your sledgehammer and you head for the car lot, find a car, bam. Next car, bam. Every car you look at, you give a whack with your sledgehammer. What do you conclude from your visit? All new cars have dents. Here's a philosophical question. Do the cars have dents before you looked at them? You can't answer the question if the only way you have to look at cars is with a sledgehammer. Following Niels Bohr, you could say that new cars that you look at all have dents and build a physical theory of dents. But you can't say anything about the nature of new cars before you look at them. Or maybe you can postulate that the looking process gave them dents, but how can you prove it if you have no before and after pictures? The issue of what things are like that you can't look at is called the hidden variables question. They are hidden because you can't measure them, like the prior state of a new car before you hit it with a sledgehammer. If you take an extreme view that there is no prior state, then describing a car before you look at it is meaningless. Our remark about where a photon ends up in a two-slit experiment says, in essence, if we really mean that it's unpredictable, then there are no hidden variables that could give us this information. The basic measurement problem in physics at the atomic level is very much like the problem you have looking for new cars in our story. Physicists can only measure things at the atomic and nuclear level using relatively huge devices and relatively huge amounts of energy. We can't examine a single electron or photon without using tools that involve trillions of electrons and without energy levels that seriously disrupt what we're trying to see. It's impossible to say exactly what effect all of these nearby electrons and all the extra energy has on our measurements. This points to another feature of basic physics. Unobservability. The energy of observation changes what we are observing because of the sensitivity to observation energy, which goes up as size gets smaller, and the energy that we are using goes up as the resolution gets smaller. And I'll explain this right now. The smaller the thing you want to look at, the less mass it has, of course. The less kinetic energy, the less everything. We know this from our world. You'd rather be hit by a Nerf ball than a Mack truck. The second thing is, the smaller the thing we want to look at, the higher frequency of light we need to use. This is something that's true of all waves, both light waves and mechanical waves, because in order to react to an object, the wave generally has to be smaller than the thing we are looking at. The sound of our voice has waves that are typically a few feet in length. Our voice may bounce off the sides of the wall or a mountainside, but it will not bounce off a needle. Bats need very high frequency sound, well above our hearing range, so that they can see small insects by bouncing sound off of them. The problem with this is, the higher the frequency, the more energy a wave photon contains. This is true for both mechanical waves and for light waves. The violin string tuned to G below middle C is less stressed and takes less energy to bow than the string tuned to E 2 octaves above middle C. For light, the energy of a photon is proportional to the light frequency. There's a formula, E equals HF. It's called Planck's law. Here's the frequency, and here's the energy of that of a photon. It is inevitable that if you look for smaller and smaller objects, at some point, the photon energy becomes large enough that it disturbs what you're looking at. And this crossover occurs when photons interact with electrons. This is the reason why X-rays can be dangerous, because they are very energetic and can change or destroy the atoms and molecules that they pass through. But this measurement problem in the quantum world does not extrapolate to the ordinary macro world of our experience. In our world, we have many ways to look at things that do not materially disrupt what we're looking at. When we look at the moon, in fact, getting back to Einstein's question, we're looking passively. Whether we look or not has no material effect on the physics of the moon, which we see by reflected light from the sun. There are two reasons why Heisenberg and Bohr's concerns do not apply to our world. One is that the energy levels in our world are so huge that the pinching effect of individual photons do not make much difference. But a more important reason is that there is a continual flow of photons constantly bombarding every speck of the visible world, so that even if an observation is needed to objectify something, it's provided to us gratis by this bombardment of photons. So, using Bohr's term, we can say a lot about the visible world. Even when we do engage in active looking, such as touching or pointing a light beam on an object, the energy involved is minuscule. To summarize, the process of looking for photons and electrons is similar to looking for new cars with a sledgehammer. In this sense, the discrete point-like localization of a photon or electron may be a result of our observation, just as the dent is the result of our looking at a car. It is as if the measurement process is like a crystal seed placed in a supersaturated liquid. It causes a wave-like particle to coalesce. Before we measure it, the electron or photon is wave-like. After we measure it, it's particle-like. So, here is his response to Bohr and Heisenberg. Does the electron exist before I measure it? Yes, but not as a localized particle. Does a photon exist before I measure it? Yes, but not as a localized particle. Do I understand precisely what's going on? No, and neither do Bohr and Heisenberg. Do I conclude that there is no objective electron before I measure it? No. Is the world illusory? No. Probably would not make some philosophers very happy. But anyway, let's go on. Let's go to the uncertainty question. Some people seem to think that the discovery, and I put this in quotes, of uncertainty in quantum mechanics was a profoundly disquieting event. In fact, one social scientist, Stanley Aronowitz, made the following statement. Since physics has discovered the uncertainty principle, it can no longer provide reliable information about the physical world and has lost its claim to objectivity. I hope I can convince you that this is a profound misreading of the facts. Yes, quantum mechanics did bring in a new appreciation of uncertainty. But the real question is, does this new understanding have any practical consequences in our macro world? Does it mean in particular that it's no longer possible to provide reliable information about the physical world? The concept of uncertainty has been around at least since Isaac Newton. When quantum physics appeared, it forced physicists to look more closely at the concept. What physicists found is that the laws of physics were not complete. They had not thought carefully about the way things work, and their speculations were not quite right when applied to the quantum world. When they thought more carefully, it was evident that measurement error, which had been swept under the rug previously, had to be dealt with. The result was a formal treatment of uncertainty, but it's an extension of classical physics, an advance, not a retreat. I would like to talk about two aspects of uncertainty, and then say something about uncertainty versus precision. Let's talk a bit about how the classical laws of physics were developed, taking two examples. Newton's laws of motion, things that fall out of the famous formula F equals MA, and theories of heat and pressure developed in the 1800s. First example, Newton's calculus. Newton invented calculus to develop his laws of motion. Well, there is some argument about whether he or Leibniz first discovered the calculus, but let's pass over that one for now. Calculus is a way to derive the physical laws by considering what happens in infinitesimal increments of space and time. Suppose, for example, you step on the gas and your car speeds up from 0 to 60 in 6 seconds. What is your speed? Well, you can't really say, because the speed's changing the whole time. But using Newton's methods, you chop the 6 seconds into a lot of tiny pieces and ask what your speed is in each tiny piece. Well, you still say it's changing. But the genius of Newton's method is that he saw that, yes, the speed is changing, but if the speed piece is small enough, the speed is almost constant over that tiny piece, and if you divide up the 6 seconds into small enough pieces, you can calculate the movement of your car as if the speed was constant in each tiny increment, and gradually change from piece to piece, from 0 at the start to 60 at the end. This, in 1 minute, is how calculus works. So now you can just skip your calculus course. You don't need it anymore. You divide the world up into tiny pieces and average over them. You zero in on the correct answer by alternately under- and overestimating the answer, but you object, I can't possibly measure all those little pieces. But it doesn't matter. One of the points of genius in Newton's method is that those little pieces don't matter in the end. You don't need to measure them, actually, because the logic of mathematics takes care of it for you. Another example, the theories of heat and pressure. I suppose that most people today understand that heat is not some special substance that exists in the material world. Heat is nothing more than the energy produced by rapidly moving molecules. The molecules of a warm substance are jittering around more vigorously than the molecules of a cold substance. That's essentially all heat is. It's the energy produced by motion. The same interpretation applies to air pressure. A balloon bulges out because of the molecules of air in the balloon hitting the walls, trying to get out. Boyle's law, PV equals KT, combines both pressure and temperature and expresses the net effect of a lot of rapidly moving molecules in a combined volume of air. The formal treatment of these types of calculations is called statistical physics. It's all done using classical methods. The really curious thing is that statistical explanations for heat and pressure were developed in the mid-1800s before it was even generally accepted that there were such things as atoms and molecules. Avogadro, whose number we mentioned before, 6.02 times 10 to the 23, published his theory about 1815, but many physicists did not believe in atoms and molecules until shortly after Einstein's work in 1905 on Brownian motion. Einstein's PhD thesis and papers produced the same year provided three separate ways to estimate Avogadro's number. Einstein was, incidentally, about 30% low in his estimates, but that's awfully good. The point of both of these examples is that classical physicists assumed that things happened in tiny chunks of space and time, and then they averaged them to get physical laws. They didn't assume that they knew what happened in each little chunk. It didn't matter. But when physicists started peering down to the level of individual atoms and electrons and photons, it became evident that some of their thinking was a bit sloppy and needed to be tightened up. The essential error in classical physics is that they worked with the tiny chunks and still assumed that each chunk had a specific position and momentum. To get the gas laws, for example, you assume random speeds and directions of motion and sum up to get average results. They knew they couldn't measure those speeds and positions, but it didn't matter, but they assumed that they were available if they did try to measure them. The fact is, or seems to be anyway, when you go down to the level of quantum physics, it's not possible to know both position and speed because of the measurement problem we mentioned earlier. Electrons and photons may not even have a position and speed until you measure them because of their non-locality. This uncertainty only comes in play at the tiny chunk level. By the time we get to the level of classical physics, the uncertainty averages out. Physicists have always worked with average results. That's what calculus is all about. When physicists looked at the problem of actually measuring and our uncertainty in measurement, they realized that the problem had been around for a long time. In classical physics, you talk about the resolution of a measuring device, for example, a microscope. The resolution is closely related to the wavelength of the light that's used to operate the microscope. Briefly, you can't see details that are smaller than the wavelength of the light. For visible light, that means there's a practical limit of about 1,000 times magnification for light microscopes. If you go to higher frequency light, say ultraviolet or X-rays, or to electron microscopes, then you can see higher magnifications. That's why when you go buy your optical microscope, you will not often find a microscope that claims to provide better than 1,000x amplification, because it's getting too high magnification for the wavelength of light. This was all known for a long time, but they didn't draw the logical conclusion that measurement problems should be directly reflected in the physical laws. So to the classical physicists, the physical laws represented some unattainable ideal. This was the so-called clockwork universe. In the 1920s, Heisenberg drew the logical conclusion from the measurement problem we have already discussed. To look at a small thing takes high frequency, hence high energy, because of Planck's formula. When you look at an electron by bouncing a photon off of it, you punch it with a hefty chunk of energy, and this changes its momentum. In short, you can't measure both position and momentum. Mathematically, Heisenberg showed that the product of uncertainty in position and momentum is no less than the Planck constant H. This is called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, and it's probably what Aronowitz had in mind when he made his assertion. Note that the momentum equals mass times the velocity, so if we rewrite the equation, we discover that as mass increases, uncertainty decreases. Only for very small masses, such as you find in the atomic world, does the inequality have much significance. With my stubby finger, I can stand here and point to any of those atoms in that little speck and be quite sure I am pointing in the right direction, despite uncertainty. Finally, I want to talk about uncertainty versus precision. There's a great confusion between uncertainty and precision. And Aronowitz's statement illustrates the confusion. Uncertainty has nothing to do with providing reliable information. Keep in mind the huge numbers of quantum particles that are involved in anything that goes on in the physical world. The real mystery of quantum mechanics is not the fact of uncertainty, but the almost unbelievable precision that's found in its formal equations. In fact, here's a couple of quotes that express that point of view. The formalism of quantum theory leads to results that agree with experiment with great accuracy and covers an extremely wide range of phenomena. As yet, there are no experimental indicators of any domain in which quantum mechanics might break down. And the reason the physicists would be concerned is this. To me, if there is an underlying worry about the nature of quantum mechanics, is that the theory works too well. Physical theories ultimately rest on observation and so are necessarily limited in validity. So far, no one seems to know the limitations of quantum mechanics. And I'll give you an example of accuracy. Some people seem to look on the statistical nature of quantum mechanics as if it had loosened the moral grip of classical physics, as if it were some degraded theory that admits uncertainty, imprecision, and other negative things. This is plain nonsense. It's so far from the truth that it almost defies rational discussion. Here's an example given by Richard Feynman in his book QED. He talks about measuring some numbers that describe an electron. One of these numbers is the magnetic moment. An electron acts like like the Earth. It has a north and south pole. And the magnetic moment is a measure of the strength of that pole, polar effect on electron. To compute the value of this moment requires advanced calculations using QED. And in the 1950s, the number was calculated to about 10 decimal places, I'm estimating, whether you can count it yourself, as the theoretical value for the electron magnetic moment. At that point, in 1950, there was no experimental way of even matching or coming close to that kind of accuracy. And it took another 10 years, and finally, the measured value was so-and-so, okay? Which is pretty good. Pretty good for the theory. It was one of the rare cases where the theory actually was ahead of the measure of the experiment. After quoting these values, Feynman goes on to say this. To give you a feeling for the accuracy of these numbers, it comes out like this. If you were to measure the distance from Los Angeles to New York with this kind of accuracy, it would be exact to the thickness of a human hair. That's how delicately quantum electrodynamics has in the last 50 years been checked, both theoretically and experimentally. By the way, Feynman goes on, I have chosen only one number to show you. There are other things in quantum electrodynamics that have been measured to comparable accuracy. It's worth noting that Feynman got his Nobel Prize for discovering some of the very effective ways to compute quantities like this. It was his methods that led to the accurate theoretical values. So someone who bemoans the sloppiness introduced by quantum mechanics really cannot be aware of the precision of these calculations and must be mixing uncertainty with precision. The truth is, and perhaps this is the dirty little secret of quantum physics, we don't know where or how we got the statistical equations of quantum mechanics, certainly not by a process of orderly deduction. In a sense, we just stumbled over them. It seems miraculously that we found them and that they so precisely describe the nature of things. There's an interesting contrast, if you're interested in the history of physics. If you look at the way Einstein developed his general theory of relativity, he started with very general principles and then ground, finally came up with the general theory in about 11 years. The quantum physics equations that are so accurate were just kind of There was no attempt to derive them from first principles or anything like that. The only requirement was they had to look mathematically pretty. And something that looks mathematically pretty just happened to be right. but there was no orderly derivation of the, for example, Dirac, P.A.M. Dirac, who was one of the famous early physicists. He is the one who discovered the first equations for QED, and part of his equations, something that just came out of the equations, was that there must be something called negative electrons, which we now call positrons. And he also, that was the main thing. There was not one other thing that came out of his equations that I can't think of off the top of my head. And the negative electrons or positrons weren't discovered for about 8 or 10 years after he had put his equations down. And he wasn't looking for negative electrons. They just sort of fell out of his equation. But you sort of ask yourself, how in the world did they ever come by these things? But let's go. I've got 5 minutes now to talk about the final issue, which is the truth question. The real question concerns whether there is something in the material world that exists outside ourselves. It is said that young children do not have a fully developed concept of other. Realism says there is an other. We have discussed earlier some of the features of basic physics that lead some people to conclude, wrongly, that there is no objective real material world. But whether such a real world exists is one thing. If it does exist, one can still ask whether we can know true factual things about this world. This is the truth question. In the late 1800s, there was a movement called nihilism that denied the reality of various things, but in particular, denied the ability of humans to learn and communicate truth. Nihilism asserted that everything is subjective, there is no basis for shared truths. The key features of this movement are irony, absurdity, and despair. Today, this movement lives on, especially in certain segments of academia that assert that nothing is objective or factual. Everything is subjective, there is no basis for shared truth. Aronowitz is an example. I recently read Aronowitz's book called Science as Power and came away with the impression, I hope that I am wrong, that to him, the only truths are tautologies, things that are trivially true, like my black shirt is black. The unfortunate thing about this is that without truth, the ability to persuade depends not on rational argument, but on political power, rhetorical spin, and demonizing your opponents. We've seen too much of this in recent years to just pass it off as an example of academic silliness. In order to talk about truth, we must first agree what truth is and then ask how humans can learn it. We need to be a little careful here, because if we define truth or learning about it too strictly, then we run the risk of giving up too much. It's part of our human condition that we can never see truth absolutely unless God reveals it to us. All we can do is know in part and see through a glass darkly. There is thus some conclusions of nihilism have a grain of truth. One of the lessons of modern science is that in areas where we do not have direct revelation from God, we must look on the search for truth about the world we live in as a bounding process in which we try to scope out an area and then zoom in by a process of approximation. The precision of the equations of quantum physics shows that this works very well. The systematic way of learning truth by approximation is a recent discovery, at least recent in the span of recorded history. Plato and his contemporaries were concerned with the question of truth 2,500 years ago. Plato believed that objective truth existed, but he puzzled over how humans can get hold of it. He was keenly aware that the five senses that humans possess are faulty. They can and do give out wrong information on a regular basis. So Plato did not believe that truth can be learned through the faulty senses. Then how do you learn true things? Plato, actually he credits Socrates with this, came up with the idea that our minds are born with built-in knowledge. This was the Socratic method of questioning. The Socratic method has the purpose to draw out from us the things we already know by asking probing questions. And a second notion that Plato had was that behind the observable world is the true world of shadows or forms or ideals. The human is born with knowledge of this world of ideals. We recognize a certain thing as a chair because we have an inborn knowledge of the chair ideal. When some people today say that mathematicians are Platonists, they refer to the mathematician's belief in the truth of abstract concepts, such as pi and so on. I am a mathematician, and I agree that pi is real, but I do not go so far as to believe in a shadow world of real chairs and such. We may laugh today at how Plato resolved the question of learning truth by having people born with it. But the important thing to realize is why he was led down that path. It's because he did not appreciate the usefulness of faulty information. Because of the power of his philosophy and his contemporaries, the scholarly world was stuck with that mindset, and it did not emerge from until about AD 1500, when gradually the empirical sciences began to develop, and those that believed in empirical methods developed persuasive arguments in favor of data collection and experimentation. In science today, there is no need to postulate that humans are born with a built-in record of truth. We may be born as humans with a unique ability to reason, and perhaps some of it is built in, but that view is not necessary to maintain a concept of truth. The scientific method argues we obtain truth by observing the world in a systematic way. Each observation is faulty, but by frequent repetition and carefully designed tests, we converge on true facts about the world around us. For all of quantum physics, findings of uncertainty, non-locality, and the rest, the empirical principle has not changed. In fact, it has been strengthened because the concept of uncertainty is part of the formal equations. The important thing to grasp here is that the finding of truth in science is a limiting process. Suppose I measure the new moon's position. As my equipment gets tuned, I get more expert. I can finally determine the moon's position to within an inch. Let's restate this in a technically correct way. I find the moon's position to within an inch, and there's less than one chance in a million that I'm wrong. If you don't like these odds, I can increase the stated error and make the odds of being wrong even smaller. Question. If I do this, do I know the moon's position? Or back up, can I assert that the moon exists? I would say yes to both questions, but some philosophers would say no. I would say yes because I can make finer and finer measurements that converge to a point. They say no because I can never measure the mathematical point. I can never be absolutely sure, even though I might point out that ocean tides and any number of other effects indicate that the moon must be located where I say it is. At the start of this talk, we talked about simplicity as one of the striking features of the world of basic physics. How could this exist only in our minds, especially if the specific nature of this simple world can be verified by independent observers? How can it be just a social consensus? I'd like to just summarize with a statement by Einstein, which I think is a very interesting statement. Einstein said, thinking about quantum mechanics and classical physics and all the questions, "Subtle is the Lord, but malicious he is not." When asked by a colleague what he meant by that, he replied, "Nature hides her secrets because of her essential loftiness, but not by means of a ruse." In Einstein's view, the material world is subtle. It takes careful study to ferret out its mysteries, but it does not mock our logic, our rationality, and sanity. Einstein's own work, as well as the work of all prominent physicists, is based on the fact that the material world is logically constructed and follows broad principles with great precision, such as the conversion, the conservation laws. Even the randomness and indeterminacy of modern physics are bounded by strict rules of behavior that are followed in minute detail. Yes, the quantum world is different from the classical world in our experience, but the differences, for the most part, have understandable sources. They remain mysteries, but they are not the sort that lead to a fundamental confusion about the nature of the world we live in, unless a person is inclined to read into them such confusions. Thank you.